In studio this afternoon with the Mirai crew and Mr. Peter Warren. Hello, Peter.
Hello, everybody. Thanks again for
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Inviting me down. It's been a fun couple of days.
Yeah, been busy.
Just a little busy.
Yeah, a little busy.
Been fun.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been fun.
Yeah, it's always fun when you're here.
I guess relative to when I travel with you and see how much you get work during workshops, it's pretty light.
Yeah,
I would say.
Are you guys just used to that? Like when you go somewhere, you just get like siphoned for all your energy?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll never forget driving across Texas from one gig to another and seeing the oil fields and watching those pumps extracting the oil out of the ground. And I was, it had just this like haunting feeling of like, I relate.
Wow.
Like you're the ground.
Mother Earth.
You're the, oh my goodness.
You're the oil. Wow.
Yeah. 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 The boneside juju being extracted.
Like, me no, too. Like,
that's pretty dramatic. That's getting mined. It's pretty dramatic, but yeah,
it's,
no.
It's not that bad nowadays, though. I mean,
no.
Kind of like avoid that kind of gigs and pass those on to the new generation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Todd Schlafer, man.
We've done our time.
We did. We put in our time. You feel like your career now, post apprenticeship and really putting in that hardcore time is, you're now able to be selective like that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Just kind of doing, working with clients that are sort of styles and ideas that mesh and doing sort of workshops at the same place. I do up at Willebog, mm-hmm. place you know well. You know, going up there three times a year, seeing the same people. Been doing that for like 4 years. And so it's just sort of seeing that continual improvement.
Right.
Just makes it a lot more worthwhile than just going to one place for one time and then never seeing people again.
Right. Hi, I'm Peter. Yeah. Bye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that did that.
Yeah.
Found places that I enjoyed, found places that, you know, we didn't mesh well. And that was fun while it lasted.
Isn't that interesting though? Like, it really is. A discussion of compatibility on like every level being a bonsai professional. Like, do you get along from the human perspective? Do your ideas about bonsai coincide?
Yeah.
You know, does your sort of, and this is one thing that I found, do your long-term goals and behavior sort of match up? Because I think one thing Todd and I were talking about when he was here doing the podcast is, you know, going and doing work on a tree and then looking on the internet or social media or hearing from other professionals like, oh, that tree that you made. Yeah. So and so totally restyled it. And it was just like, you can't be mad at it. I mean, it's somebody else's tree that they paid you to do work on and they paid somebody else to do work on. But it's just like, that's an interesting sort of mishmash of feelings and thoughts to kind of reconcile.
It is. And the people who do that, maybe if they don't have the same kind of, like you say, long-term goals and if they're incompatible, then you just don't do work. You just don't. Just next time they ask you, I'd say, I'm busy.
Yeah.
I'm washing my hair that weekend.
Yeah, right.
Or are you just, you know, okay, if you want me to do that and you're just going to waste my time and your time and everybody's time, then you're going to have to pay me three times what I normally ask for.
Yeah.
Because it's not fun then.
Who is or what is a compatible situation for Peter Warren as a bonsai professional in terms of mentality, scope?
Just to sort of, I mean, we can have different aesthetic goals in a sense, but just the same, the kind of like level of commitment, I would say.
Mm.
And, you know, when you leave and, or, you know, when you ask people to do something, you know that it's going to get done to the best of their abilities. They're going to put as much effort in as they can. You know, they're the people who kind of like most enjoy working with and where we both end up with the best results.
Yeah.
You know, as long as they're doing it to the best of their abilities and the best of their, you know, the time can permit, then that's all that you can ask from people, really.
Yeah. Koba housing some dog food over here.
He's going for it.
As we're podcasting.
Finished his food, started eating the plastic.
Chief. Need more. Kendall was commenting on Koba's figure the other day.
Yeah, he's on a diet.
The veracity with which that dog is feeding right now, it goes beyond anything we've witnessed from Koba
to
date.
He gets taken care of. He's...
No, it's not an abusive situation at all. That is for sure.
He just finished eating his raw meat dinner, so.
Jeez. the Prince Koba.
Meat nuggets.
Do you notice a shift in the way that Bonesai is being practiced in the UK, or is there a consistency to it?
I definitely notice people who I'm working with see their levels improving and their sort of levels of commitment improving and knowledge and things like, and just quite a lot of that is down to yourselves. It's quite funny when you come across people who watch Mirai Live and things like that, some of the vocabulary that they suddenly come out and start talking about, you know, things that you just like, okay, that's Ryan talking right there.
Yes.
So we were doing a workshop the other day and somebody started talking about like vascular tissues and stuff like that. And I was just like, was that on last week?
Wow.
So, you know, like your influence is definitely spreading worldwide. So you've got something to be proud of. But I don't know. It's difficult to say.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I was looking at some of the comments that were made on Instagram when we promoted the Maple stream last night. And one of the ones that really stuck out to me, somebody had said that you're the most underrated Bonesai professional.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah.
And I felt like that was as truthful as any comment that I've ever seen made. I think, you're very quiet. You're extremely humble. You might even start blushing. You know, it seems like you're steadfast and really quiet, consistent nature with which you work with trees also permeates in just to the way that you work as a professional, which makes sense that in Bonesai, you know, Bonesai is such a reflection of the individual. And in the world of everybody screaming, look at me, the underrated in terms of you not trumpeting your own horn, it's cool, you know, depending on how you look at it, it is cool for people to get to experience the level of your skill set and knowledge, you know, and Mirai Live being able to, not like you need it at all, but Mirai Live being able to give you the ability to just show that. And I don't know how valuable that is for you as a professional, but for me, it's valuable as your friend that people know what you're capable of.
I appreciate that. I think it's very valuable from the perspective of, it's kind of our job as sort of Japanese trained bonsai professionals to have experienced that practice at the highest level, to sort of share our knowledge and to share our experiences. You know, that was kind of like one of the things that the chief sort of said to me. It was just like, you know, go out and spread the word of bonsai. It doesn't necessarily have to be spread the word of Japanese bonsai. It's just spread the word of bonsai and kind of like do it in your own way. But, you know, make sure people know that this is what it's all about.
Mm.
And that it requires this kind of level of commitment and this level of thought and just, you know, passion, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's good to be able to sort of share that and show that. But I mean, in terms of sort of blow my own trumpet and things like that, I've never been one for that, as you know. But it's the best advertisement is the ones that other people give you. Like some of the best people that I have and clients and things like that have come from other recommendations. You know, so I've worked with somebody and they've recommended me to somebody else, and those kind of relationships are the ones that last the longest.
Yeah.
I find, you know. So, because it's like-minded people are always, okay, I know that you're going to get on with this guy. You should go and see Peter and you'll work with him and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that. And so that's what I tend to kind of like, well, I don't really want to advertise myself too much. I want people to come and find me.
Yeah.
Rather than me to force myself upon them.
Yeah, it's almost like a filter of sorts.
Yeah.
Interesting. And that's intentional.
To a certain degree, yeah.
And it's just Peter being Peter too.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not the most sociable of people, so social media and me. If there was anti-social media, I'd probably get quite on that.
Dude, your social media posts are the best.
Yeah. Because they're so infrequent. Classic.
Yeah, infrequent, but when they're made, they do pack a punch.
Well, you see, it's you know, you've got to be thoughtful about these things. You know?
Yeah,
it's
just, yeah. Just,
and, you know, you've got to show a little bit of the playful side of things as well.
Yeah.
Can't take it all too seriously.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, the one you wrote when you came to Mariah was pretty funny. With Poppy.
Yeah, right.
Like, this long-winded, like, it was so beautiful to go out to Oregon because I wanted to see Poppy again.
This is pretty much one of the biggest reasons to come out here.
The only reason.
Just, like, the 1 minute that I got to hold her in the car park last night.
Seeing
was just,
you
like,
reunited. That was beautiful, yeah.
And she was so disinterested as well, but that made me want to be around her even more.
She doesn't give her love easily.
Mm. I know, it just made me want to be around her even more.
Yeah. Hard to get. I feel like Kendall sympathizes with that more than anybody.
I know. I just want her to come up to me and, like, I'm always so excited to see her and she could care less.
Yeah. She just snorts.
She, like, sniffs me and is like, yeah, I'll see you later.
This is random.
I know all about this.
Pug.
You don't have anything for me. This is how I feel with Koba. I feel so rejected by that dog. We used to have such a stellar relationship and I feel like it slipped and I don't know
He's
what
a fickle pickle.
Right.
Kendall, sometimes he doesn't, you know, like me that much either.
Kendall brought up also that once we got Bear in the office, we were like, oh, well, the bar has been set.
Yeah, without
way
a doubt.
Way higher for snuggle time with puppies.
Bear would come and jump into your lap rather unathletically, but nevertheless gave it a good attempt to be a snuggle dog.
Yeah.
Yeah, Everett
flying
was
sausage.
Aggressively snuggling.
Yeah, yeah.
Dachshunds think it's their right to snuggle anything that they want.
Yeah.
Amen. Who's to Bear stop was great. Yeah.
Good therapy dog.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What, you know, now sort of moving forward and stuff, is it the evolution of trees and sort of the students that you've found that relationship with that motivates you and sort of drives you? Or what, you know, what do you find bonsai-wise that keeps the well full and Peter moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, just seeing people's collections evolve and improve is always that's essentially one of the biggest parts of what we do is making sure that, that's how I see it, is making sure that people who want to enjoy bonsai can enjoy it and that their trees evolve and that their collections are constantly improving rather than just sort of managing decline of trees. But then from a personal perspective, it's just sort of, I'm just trying to make the time and to work on some of the trees that I really like and just develop those. And it's hard though, you know, constantly trying to, like, as we were sort of saying over the last couple of days, you know, life gets in the way and just trying to find that balance.
Yeah.
But those little moments where you get and, you know, just had a couple of days of repotting at home and, a couple of people, Bonsai Egypt, came over from Ireland to help us, and just it was one of the two, like, very, very cold days. We were repotting in the snow and it was just awful, but it was two of the greatest days ever because we just, like, managed to create some things in just awful conditions, and it was fun again.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of like letting the creativity go a little with the limited resources that we had. It was good fun, you know. Mm-hmm. Just reignite the spark a little bit more.
Nice. You get a pretty significant charge when the creativity flows and you see sort of magic happen.
Yeah, there was the one tree that we were talking about yesterday with a little the taxus.
Uh-huh.
The sort of Shohin sort of taxus that I wanted to chop up. When we got that on the rock and it all kind of, like, worked out and I looked at it, I did a little dance. I'm not ashamed to admit it.
Hot diggity dog.
Hot diggity dog.
Woo!
I did the gold dance. It's like, oh, shit. Because realized, you know, it's the realization of what you've been kind of, like, thinking about. It's just been bubbling away in the back of your mind and just that kind of slow burn evolution of that bonsai can have, and it just suddenly comes true in front of you. And then that's just like, wow, yeah.
Mm. Do you do you like, you know, there's so many different ways to go about creating bonsai. Do you like the process? Does the process motivate you, or do you like the product?
Oh, it's the process.
Yeah.
Constantly. I mean, it's everything that we do. It's just about it's how we do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the things that we do, they're going to die. They're not going to make it. And so if you don't enjoy the process of doing it, and you're only just obsessed with the product, the end result, then when you have those disappointing times when things don't go wrong,
mm-hmm.
then that's when you kind of like, you could, I don't know, lose motivation and
yeah,
look at giving up. But if you understand that is part of the overall process, then, and it's the steps that you're making, then that's where I think the real kind of enjoyment comes from it. And if you do that process correctly, then eventually your product will come.
Mm-hmm.
The end result will come, whatever that may be.
What sucks the bonsai joy out of Peter Warren?
What sucks the bonsai joy out of Peter Warren?
Yeah, what ruins it? All right, where do you find those moments of sort of discouragement? Because you know failure is inevitable. Pursuing bonsai is like a lesson in dealing with failure.
When that failure could be avoided easily.
Ah.
I think that's where it is. I mean, sometimes things happen and there's just kind of like, or you push it too far and that can happen. But it's when it's like simple things that happen, like trees get poorly watered or, you know, they don't get looked at properly and, you know, somebody's looking at it and they can see that something's not right, but they don't ask you what the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, why didn't you ask me like 2 months ago?
Mm-hmm.
Now, why didn't you get in contact? It's like, particularly these days where you can take a picture, send it off straight away. What's the problem? I can reply, nothing's the problem. Or, oh dear, right, I'll be around as soon as I possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
Now, stuff like that kind of like sucks the joy out of it.
Yeah. Just discouraging
just
to see it.
It's like, oh.
Yeah. Interesting.
But, you know, that's all part of it. It's, you know, you just got to kind of like take the rough with the smooth.
Yeah.
And, you know, whenever trees do die like that, and it's one thing, I mean, it's no kind of consolation, but the reason why bonsai are so beautiful is that they're alive. And the flip side of that is that they die. Mm. So you just got to accept that part as part of it.
Do you think that bonsai dying gives you a greater appreciation of when they're living and thriving?
Absolutely, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never really thought about that before. I mean, I know it sucks when they die. It's devastating, right? It's like losing a child. Well, I mean, maybe not quite to that extent. now that I have a child, I can honestly say it's not probably doesn't carry that much weight. Right.
All right, yeah.
Right. Right.
It's not fun.
Like
it's horrible.
Yeah.
That is.
It's gut-wrenching.
Yeah. And it gets worse the more you invest in it.
Yeah.
The more time and love you invest in it, the harder it gets. I mean, obviously, there's a financial aspect to it, but
sure.
You can suck that up.
Yeah.
But even if it's just like a relatively cheap tree that you've invested a lot of time into, it's just like, oh, dude.
Yeah.
Do you always get rid of like dead trees? Do you have to like not look at them anymore?
No, I've got them around the back of my polytunnel. I just every time I've got to go around and look at them and just remind myself that.
Okay. Wow. Slightly masochistic.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Do better.
That's like whipping yourself.
It is, yeah. It is.
Because you burn them or get rid of them.
I can't touch them.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have to leave.
Yeah, see.
Troy, trees that die, Troy is the one who tends to those.
Hands off. Yeah, he's like, I can't.
Yeah, they have to go. I can't hang, you know, because I mean, I think for me it's the self-criticism of why that tree died and looking at all of the shortcomings. Yeah, bud. Okay, we'll get you a snack. The shortcoming and of you know, whatever it is that I didn't do or sort of failed to do, I already know. You know, I know, and in the back of my mind, I'm way harder on myself than anybody. And this is even true in my apprenticeship in Japan. I felt the mistakes that I made that Mr. Kimura decided it was going to be imperative that he reinforce. I felt them more than any of his reprimand ever made me feel. You know, I didn't even need that from him. It was it made it doubly as interesting to deal with having that. But, so not taking part in sort of that last finality to that tree for me is so almost like a self-preservation thing. Like, yeah, I let you down, bud. You know, like I really did, because ultimately outside of like, and you could even say with random occurrences of insects and borers or things like that, you could have been more on top of identifying those issues. You could have had the live vein clean. You could have been more responsive to the tree. And I think for me, throughout my apprenticeship in Japan and even at, and particularly at Bonsai Mirai, I recognize that most errors and fatalities come from negligence on my part, not trusting my gut, not following my intuition. It's made me stronger as a bonsai practitioner to jump on things before they happen. And that I always admired Mr. Kimura because he proactively dealt with issues, and that's why he had so much success. Yeah. He would walk around the garden and have a cigarette every morning, and all of a sudden we'd be doing something to a tree that I'm looking at and I'm being like, dude, this is healthy. What are we doing? And if something about it, he was like, this is not right. And we always, and it was like, I'm sure he learned that the hard way as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. The chief was always, he always said that. It's like, you know, the cost for him to learn bonsai was well over $1 million.
Yeah.
Because that's how many, you know, that's how the value of trees that he'd killed through his career.
Right.
But yeah, it's just down to, you know, we kill them.
Yeah.
That's part of it, sadly.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is a part of it.
You try and minimize it as much as you possibly can, but.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting thing. It is interesting to think about sort of the brutality of that growth, you know, and the sort of the martyrdom. To a degree of that growth.
The fallen soldiers.
Yeah. The fallen soldiers, the ones that open the door to another level of higher practice and pursuit. And I think it's also interesting when you talk about the monetary aspect of it. That's always the last consideration. Absolutely, in my mind. Yeah. It's never like, oh, I just lost a super valuable tree. It's like, oh, yeah. I just lost a really special tree.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. To think about that.
Let's go to something a little bit more lively.
I know.
Talking about death. It's just kind of like a little bit too down.
Morose. The gray Oregon weather really fosters these deep dives into the human psyche.
Mm. This is sunny, man. This is glorious.
Yeah, I guess coming from the UK.
Yeah, you're right. Goodness, who are we talking to?
Yeah.
Yes. Overcast and 58 degrees.
Mm. It's getting sunburnt. Yeah, it's crazy.
It's really awesome. I did an article for Bonsai Esprit about grow lights, because it's quite an important part of kind of trying to grow a lot of species for us in the UK, and we got 40% less. Dude,
Kuba is now burying a tree. He's trying to bury a tree, and he's digging through our pillows.
Did you hear? Kuba whining as he was walking around?
That's what that was.
That was anxiety.
He's stressed. He couldn't find a place to hide it.
He's like, I gotta hide it. I can't let anybody find it. And he's like, where do I hide it? And he's like, looking at people like, can you help me?
But you see, he hid it, and he was like, fine with it. He laid down, and then he got up and went and got it again. He was like, that wasn't good enough.
Find it.
I can see it from here.
Good luck, young Koba.
Hide it well, Koba.
He's doing the nose shove right now.
Yeah. Into pillows.
Yeah.
Oh. Good job, Koba. You found a spot.
Never a dull moment.
So grow lights.
Yeah. So
it's dark. It's that dark.
Yeah. I mean, we have 40% less sun than say Spain. Throughout the year.
Like, I feel like Spain's
like over the whole
sunny
of the UK.
Yeah, like incident, like the amount of like sun energy, the full.
Everybody just needs vitamin D there.
40% less. when I looked at that, I was just like, huh. That's why we can't grow bonsai like they do in Spain.
Yeah. Do you think Spaniards are happier than British people?
Yeah.
Do you think?
Oh, categorically, yes.
Categorically, do you think that contributes to the sarcastic, dark humor that comes
Absolutely,
out of the
yeah.
UK? Really?
It's like why all the great literature, all the great music has come out of England because we're always indoors.
Wow,
got nothing else to do.
Brooding.
Yeah, brooding.
Yeah.
Wow. Kind of like Portland.
Kind of like Portland.
A lot of good music came out of the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
It's grunge. You ever heard of it?
Yeah, right. A little band named Nirvana.
Yeah. Pretty sad lot.
Yeah.
Wow. But it does. I mean, like the climate affects us, you know, our environment affects us like more than we could possibly imagine. And I think that's one thing that we try to bring out in our bonsai. And I'm still waiting for people to really kind of latch onto that, try and bring out sort of trees that represent the UK landscape and things like that. It's still not caught root, I don't think.
What are trees like in the UK?
Deciduous. Big and spreading. We don't really have mountains. So I was sort of seeing a lot of the mountain, like juniper images and stuff in Japan. I was just like, what is that?
Where did that come from?
Where do those trees grow? Because I never had like any kind of like inkling of what bonsai was before I saw all of these trees. I knew they were powerful and they were kind of like very, you know, interesting, but it's just nothing that really sort of resonated with what I grew up in. I'd never been up a mountain.
Wow, that's interesting.
And you know, but whereas you grew up in the Rockies, and yeah, so they were around you the whole time,
right out the front door. Do you feel like do you feel now, looking back at sort of that environment that you grew up in, that is framing your approach as a bonsai practitioner, and that is an influence?
Yeah, oh, yeah, it is. I try and make it as much of an influence as we can.
You embrace that.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to see the deciduous trees look like the ones that are outside.
Uh huh. Yeah. I felt that on the maple stream that you did. That was pretty cool to sort of watch that.
Well, one thing I'd like to try and do is try and make some young looking deciduous trees. So we kind of said that with the azalea stream earlier as well. I mean, like we always kind of focus on the age aspect of bonsai, but you know, there could be young trees out there as well.
You said that to me a while back. You said that you had challenged a ceramicist to make the youngest looking pot possible.
Did I?
Yeah, you were like, you guys are trying to put these patinas and you're using these subdued colors, and like, how about make like the shiniest, brightest pot possible?
Wow.
And I was just like, that was in the same way that elongating the design of the juniper that you did several years ago. Really, really like that. It was literally like a cracking open of a door that I had never thought to open. And it really influenced my work. But then when you said that, it was such a rabbit hole for like, imagine that. It's a really, really innovative concept, man. I don't know if that ever came to fruition, but...
Stone Monkey did. I think it was probably what we were talking about.
Did he?
He made some real nice sort of shiny porcelain pots with some really nice bright glazes and stuff on there.
Ah.
I don't think they were very commercially successful.
Ah, yeah, well.
So
now you're bucking the trend a little bit.
Apologies, Andy.
Trendsetter. You're ahead of the curve.
Sorry, Andy.
Ahead of the
curve.
I've led him down a few garden paths that led into the undergrowth and didn't really come out anywhere. Sorry, man.
Oh, that's
but
awesome.
But, you know, you've got to explore these things.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole idea of that sort of cracked seal on, like, at what entry point does this piece of material allow access to a stage of life that's representative to this species at this time came from that idea that you had. For me, that approach came from that conversation that you and I had, and I was just like, I need to think about this.
I don't know when we had that conversation, but some, you know, Peter Snow, we talked about things like that in terms of, like, you know, making deadwood look old, and he's like, well, what kind of, you know, deadwood can be, it could have died off yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, what stage of a tree's evolution are you trying to show? I mean, it could just be a snapshot of one day in this tree's kind of like life. It doesn't, you're not necessarily having to make it look as old as you possibly can.
Right.
And he said that one time when I was up there, up at Willowbog, and I was just, again, that was a moment. And it's like, it just changed the way you think and changed the perspective of things. So
it's like a, what was that meme of that chef throwing like the salt on the, with his little arm motion, you know, it's just like a little salt bit of bay. Spice in the bonsai cauldron. Just taste that for a little while, you know, it's like, growing, changing.
My friend went to his restaurant in Turkey, I believe it is.
Uh-huh.
It was very all right.
At one point he's sorry, just like, guy. I mean, sorry. Dude, but he apparently said at one point, he's like,
because
he comes out and he cuts it like how he's in those videos, but eventually he's like, can I just
eat my steak. Right. You need to stop throwing it around and just like put it on a plate. And
right. Got it.
Yeah. Wow.
Got it.
It's getting cold.
That's cool and all, but
wow,
that's pretty funny. Mm. Yeah, I feel like maybe now there's a little bit more, you know, with obviously Japanese bonsai has been around for a long time, and the pursuit of bonsai in Japan has really the cultural sort of mastery of the skill is a big part of Japanese bonsai stylistically and approach wise. I feel. And it's interesting to see these little injections of spice and sauce and flavor into that are giving, sort of throwing out these notions as opposed to just taking what is expected or accepted. And I find that to be a very beautiful thing that's happening, that those injections. And I think one thing that I've noticed, or at least heard sort of murmurs of, even from Japanese professionals, is that they're seeing opportunity to maybe add, so some of the younger generation maybe try something different than they would have prior. And not to say that the Western world is influencing Japanese bonsai, but maybe to say that it is.
Yeah, I'd say there's definite patches of influence with the people who are open to it, the younger generation who are open to it.
Yeah.
Don't see why that's not going to improve in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be interesting. I mean, I do get concerned when I see all the bonsai leaving Japan, though, or you go and you see the state of bonsai in Japan. Does that concern you at all?
It does, but it's their business to deal with, really. I mean, it's like, once it runs out. And then, I mean, it concerns me from this point of view of what does that then do to the bonsai sort of community in Europe? Does that, Is that going to sort of lead to a collapse of people too dependent on that?
Ah.
And what's that going to do to the level of kind of enthusiasm? I think that's more of my sort of concern, not as in, you know, how does that impact the Japanese bonsai world? Because it'll never finish there. It might sort of die down to nothing. But if it does, that's because there's not been a demand for it in Japan. Mm. There's not been the interest levels in it, and so it's led its natural course and it's evolved, and the fire, you know, has gone out, and it's just going to be burning embers. Maybe one day somebody will come along and add some more fuel to the fire and it'll get back up, or maybe it'll just be extinguished.
Hmm.
But that's because there isn't a demand for it.
Yeah.
And if there isn't a demand for it, then it's just going to disappear, like the way that, you know, lots of things have disappeared culturally in the past.
Yeah.
Is there less interest in bonsai in Japan now?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just not compatible with the modern life over there.
Mm. Mm.
And, I mean, there'll always be people pursuing it. We always see, like, new, younger people coming into it. But it's just not compatible with you know, people's lifestyles like it used to be.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to hear you say that you worry about the ripple effect in terms of impacting European bonsai. You feel European bonsai is dependent on Japanese?
No, I don't think it's dependent on it, but there's a larger part of it is sort of centered around, I'd say 50, it would be fair to say 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people there who like that Japanese aesthetic and like the Japanese trees.
Rightly so. Beautiful. Yeah, I mean, it's beautiful.
There's nothing wrong with that at all. But, you know, once that sort of starts to disappear, would they then gravitate towards European trees? They gravitate towards other species, different styles, different ideas.
It seemed to me, you know, when I went to the Nolander's Trophy in 2011 for the first time, my feeling when I walked into that exhibition is there was a pretty major movement towards native trees. And it felt like over the course of, you know, a few years at the Nolander's Trophy that there was a pretty significant shift back towards more emphasis being on the Japanese model. And I don't know if I was accurately seeing that because I wasn't necessarily there and engaged in the community to know if that was true or if that was just an odd year or an observation that I made. But or that I personally was seeing, but not necessarily was reflective. But it felt like it on several fronts, venue, manner of display, tertiary things surrounding exhibitions, and then the trees that were really being looked at and the opinions held of the trees by European professionals judging the exhibitions that, you know, both in Italy and in Belgium at Nolander's Trophy. I was really, I didn't know what to make of that.
Mm.
Do you feel like that is accurate, or do you feel like that's
I think people fall into like one camp or the other. It's like very polarized. You're either kind of like all about the Japanese thing, or you're just all about the European thing. And it's like, there's nobody really that kind of bridges both worlds. I suppose David Benavente does. Quite a few of the Spanish guys do.
Yeah. Yeah. The Spaniards seem to be good at that.
But what you then see a lot of is kind of a lot of the European material is styled into a Japanese way, quite a lot, rather than maybe sort of exploring a different sort of styling. But they don't have the same. I don't know really, but with a lot of people, you do sort of tend to see quite sort of polarized views on it.
Yeah, I feel like that's the same in the United States as well. I do,
and it's a shame because it just closes you off to the opportunities that are out there for you.
Yeah,
if you just say like, you know, bonsai has to be just Japanese trees, then it's like then you lose out on all the wonderful species that you have here, and then the same that we have in Europe, and equally if you close off your mind to Japanese trees, then you're just like, well, you know, there's certain beauty there, but you know, people don't necessarily need to like everything. So
yeah, how have you maintained such, I mean, watching you do the Japanese maple, and I think that is a Japanese maple made by Peter Adams, you know, outside of obviously I would say away from Japanese influence to a degree, but maybe not so much because still referencing Japanese maples from the Japanese aesthetic and some of the creation of that tree. And there were some decisions that you made that were sort of in line, and there are some decisions that you made that seemed to play on some of your taste for, you know, a tree looking like a natural tree. And then you did the Satsuki azalea repotting, and you had, as you termed it, a flower tower. And being able to play inside that aesthetic. And, you know, I asked you, do you enjoy the flower tower versus trying to use a Satsuki to convey more of a tree-like image? And you said you can respect the technical approach of the flower tower, and you respect the artistry of a more natural tree form. I mean, I don't think I know any other professional that oscillates more between all of these different worlds and approaches and functions than you inside of bonsai. It's pretty badass how broad your knowledge of that is and ability to work within that.
How easy I am, basically, is what you're saying is, you know, I'm anybody's.
I don't know. I guess I didn't intend it that way, but you can take it as you will.
The way that I see it is like every time you approach a piece of material, I mean, there's already something there. Like with that flower tower, I mean, it is what it is. There's just no way around it. And like, you can't change that. You can't change what it is, like, massively.
I mean, you could, but probably to the detriment of the tree.
You could, but you'd just be doing it for your own sake.
Right.
You know, you'd just be doing it to satisfy some desire to be radical and change it. And when you're working with kind of like more established material, things that have already had that kind of previous influence into it, it's like you can't. Necessarily, you can't always just go in and just sort of rip it up and start again. I mean, sometimes it's worth doing, particularly if it's done badly. But you have to kind of like respect like what that material has, those characteristics, and then you're just like, okay, well, how can I then maximize those? So just changing the front a little bit to show off the Nibari to its maximum front, and then just working on the branch structure so the things are just nicely balanced, and so just maximizing what characteristics that tree had. It might be boring compared to, say, like a real wild looking tree, but you maximize it, you make the best that material can have to offer, and then you've succeeded in creating a good bonsai. That's just what you got to do with every piece of material. You just got to look and try and find what characteristics that has, maximize them to its best possibilities.
Do you think that calmness and acceptance in your approach do you think that that style carries through into all of the trees that you touch, or do you get a wild hair and do you really seek to create drama
with a lot of my own things? Yeah,
really.
But like, particularly with, I mean, I work on so many trees in a year. I mean, one of my biggest clients, and he has like almost 2,000 trees. We went and we were just, before I came here, we were repotting, and we were repotting 25 to 30 trees a day.
Mm.
And that kind of like industrial level of just sort of constantly having to, you just, the next tree, the next tree, the next tree, the next tree. You can't be too fixed in your approach. You can't, because each single tree was different, even though we were doing all these different satsukis, there were lots of different styles, there were lots of different stages of development things. You just got to be so flexible with that and just roll with all those punches. I think working in that kind of like industrial level does require you to be a little bit more flexible, but equally whilst you're doing that, you can't just become a machine and just keep repeating the same thing. You've got to be like on it all the time, just thinking, is this actually the best front, and just looking. But you've got like this sort of time constraints within that, and that kind of challenge I do find interesting and exciting. Just keeps your brain just constantly working.
Does that wear you out?
It does tire you out a bit, yeah.
I would have to believe that would be exhausting.
It does, but you know, you can enjoy it as well.
Sure. The challenge is enjoy. I know working, you know, with Mr. Kimura and stuff, it's interesting your experience in bonsai and mine, because Mr. Kimura had such a stylistic stance and stamp that he put on his work that, you know, the drama was what he was known for, and that's what he always went for. And I think Mr. Kimura paid respect to the hands that had touched trees to a degree, but was always willing to say, but my hands are going to make it better.
Yeah.
You know, and I think he had that approach, and it's hard to argue with based on the results he's created and the success. Yeah. I mean, he's brilliant, and what he's done has been revolutionary, I think, in bonsai over the course of his career. And also there were times where it worked against him. It really did work against him, you know,
ego working against you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And seeing that, it was like a reminder, like, no matter how good you are, there's always moments where the ego can get in the way and really be a detriment.
Yeah.
And then sort of gauging that. But I really found that the mental game of that to be more exhausting than the physical. Towards the fifth and sixth year of my apprentice, I went home every day mentally exhausted, but not physically exhausted. And that was, I had never thought that bonsai would be mentally exhausting.
Yeah, it definitely can be.
Yeah.
Just like trying to, and working with clients and things like that, where maybe your aesthetic ideas aren't kind of like exactly on the same page. It's like, well, how do you try and convince them otherwise? Or is that just, again, like just banging your head against a brick wall, and should you just kind of just leave it and make sure that, you know, the results turning out are to their satisfaction and are not ridiculous as well, you know?
Mm.
But yeah, it's just that sort of constant thought process of, it can sort of tire you out, which is why when you then have the free rein to just do whatever you want, that's when it just becomes, that's not exhausting at all. You can just do that and for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah. I mean, working with this team, it's been interesting to, there's so many different levels of, there's like the nuts and bolts of Bonsai Mirai, and then there's like the creative of Bonsai Mirai, and the nuts and bolts are exhausting and the creative is exhausting. It's been interesting to watch this team handle and manage those two things. I think we've all expressed exhaustion on both fronts multiple times.
I think it's in when I was in school, so I went to art school, and a lot of what was told of us is that, because it was mentally exhausting after defending your work for 5 hours. You're just like, oh my God, I haven't moved, but I've sat here thinking about it so intensely that, yeah, it's tiring.
You're tapped.
It's so tapped. Yeah. That one critique would tap me out for a week, because I would just be like, woo, like that was a lot to think about.
Right.
But that being said, the, you know, thing that we would always say is like, it's hard to think and make at the same time, like reflect on what you're making as you're making it. And sometimes you just have to oscillate between like, okay, now I'm just going to make, and then I'm going to reflect on it.
Mm.
Like, and so ever since I graduated school, I go through transitions where I'll make work for 6 months and then I'll take a break for 6 months and think about what I just made. Or I mean, it's not always half and half, but
sure,
it is interesting that the human mind has, when you're making something creative, you, it's almost impossible to be so self-reflective and so introspective that you're analyzing as you make. Mm-hmm. Because so much of making is intuitive. And if you're, I don't know, I mean, it happens with me when I try to think too much about what I am making, then, and sort of go against my intuition, I fail.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you see that happening with making bonsai trees.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt, you have to step away from it.
Well, mm-hmm. sometimes you just got to let it flow.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I think that's a really, and I think what you just said is really interesting to think about in creative pursuits. And I'm sure this is something that people who are trained in art or are artists, you know, like doing bonsai, are we artists? Are we not? Like that conversation is so tiring, but I think it's hard to deny that there's creativity and inspiration that goes into the creation of some trees, and you can stymie it. You can really stymie it by trying to overanalyze and justify. And that is, for me, I think Mr. Kimura had some very famous junipers, and I remember him pulling one of them into the workshop one day, and he just started lopping branches off. And I was just like, whoa, you know, and he looked at me and he said, when you got this feeling, you just got to go with it. Like he wasn't even feeling saucy today. Let's make some bonsai, you know, and that kind of inspired work. Like he would nuts and bolts reason through a lot of work, but then like he had these moments where he just, it was just like conversation stopped. You really saw him just in this moment where he was like, we're doing this now. And it was really impressive. The product of that was always very different than a lot of the more reasoned work that he would do. And it was dramatic. It was. And it was like, whoa.
Chief always used to do that after he'd had a few beers. And the results were always very, very different.
That's awesome. Results may vary.
Yeah. God, caution.
But yeah, he would just get in that mood, and he was just like, let's get out of the chainsaw, boys. Don't think so there, Chief.
The old Makita. Yeah.
Wow. The old Makita.
Just busting him out.
Well, watching you on Mirai Live, I've seen you made decisions that you're after. Like, I didn't even think about that too much, but I just did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, like, it turned out really good. Like, a lot of times it was just like the slab planting, we made it, and then you're like, should I put this second tree on? Yeah. And it was like, sure, let's do it.
And we were like, nah.
Yeah, we're like, nah. Shit. And you're like, no, let's do it. And then it really amplified that. I mean, it's obviously impossible to tell, but that spontaneity of the live stream, sometimes, does it give you an edge sometimes with making work?
I think so. Yeah. I think so. And I this is where, you know, I think there's a lot of controversy in bonsai around, do demonstrations have a place in bonsai? And I think there are different personalities in the way that demonstrations cater to that personality, work for some people and doesn't work for other people. I really like being pushed, and I really like, I like to improvise. And I think there's a lot of wonderful things that come out of improvisation. I think that early on in my career, improvisation was dangerous, you know, where there wasn't a whole lot of buffer. There wasn't a whole lot of knowledge of what can happen. If the train gets too much momentum, you can roll right through the stop. And I think part of the experience of having done bonsai on stage as a demonstrator a lot, and then Mirai Live, has definitely sharpened the skills of being able to improvise within an acceptable range. But I really like that. I really like demonstrations. I still think for people that enjoy that moment to moment interaction with a tree and just letting it flow, I think that they still show a very beautiful part of bonsai, which is, you know, Mr. Kimura in his saucy state deciding to lop off a bunch of branches, and what comes from it is pretty, pretty amazing. I think that's a beautiful thing to be able to show, but I think it's dangerous too. And I think there's the danger in it is seen more than the beauty of it.
Mm. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, sometimes you just, before you start a demonstration, sometimes you just don't want to see the material.
Yeah, sometimes.
You're just like, because you can then just overthink it, and you're just like, oh, you're just like, okay, I just want to be put on the spot, and then just see what happens.
Yeah.
Sometimes it turns out okay, and sometimes it doesn't. But
sometimes it really doesn't. Yeah. But I think too, that's where Japan for me was pretty paramount, because I think when you see a lot of demonstrations fail, you know, like you're saying, the chief, you were talking about it in terms of the repotting of the Satsuki. You're saying the chief, it was just like, go, go, go. There's a speed, there's an efficiency, there's a monetary aspect to the work that you're doing. Inside of that, the golden ticket is executing to perfection,
yeah,
with monetary restrictions, time restraints, pressure, pressure, pressure. And Mr. Kimura put those same amounts of pressure on us as apprentices, but yet you had to still be able to pump the brakes and know when it's time to accelerate and when it's time to brake and go into that curve, that hairpin turn. And that going past that point, flying off the edge of the road, missing the hairpin, not braking enough, or being too conservative and not meeting that pressure and that pace, like enough of that sort of sharpens your blade to be able to know, at least for me, flying past that and getting chewed out and having my own judgment about myself is what allows me to know that sensation when I'm in the danger zone and I need to step back for a moment and just make sure what I'm doing is actually what I feel is appropriate. And you see students, at least I do at Mirai, you see students and you can watch, particularly in the pruning process, which is why it's one of the most dangerous things to teach and allow people to execute on trees that aren't theirs. You can see the momentum building,
yeah,
in the reduction of a tree.
Yeah.
I cut this off. I cut this off. Well, let's just cut this. Let's cut it all off. And pretty soon you're like, oh my gosh, what did you just do?
There's no more tree.
There's no more tree left here. Like, holy cow. Yeah. But having been through that and experienced that momentum and how it can build and stuff is what allows you to self-check. And also as an instructor, I think allows you to help your students regulate and find those, yeah, danger zones and learn that sensation that they can then use to buffer their bonsai practice.
Absolutely. I mean, doing the maple stream last night, I mean, that pruning, if I'd have been at home, that would have been at most half an hour, could have done that.
Sure.
Broken up, you know, done all that. But just, it pays to just go slow at first and just go through things carefully and,
mm-hmm,
with that pruning process so that momentum doesn't build up.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you're a hobbyist, an enthusiast, there is no time restraints.
Yeah.
To a large extent. You're there to enjoy it. You should take the pressure off. It's not a competition. It's not like who can do it the quickest,
mm-hmm,
who can do it the hardest. And just go through it just carefully, just holding yourself back, making sure that the brake's on until you've got the confidence, until you've had that experience to know
the sensations. Yeah.
when you're building up, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I had an interesting...
Just to keep stepping away and looking from a distance, not just...
motoring forward. Runaway train.
And that could, you know, there could be a lot of that kind of like alpha, like masculinity aspect to doing bonsai. You know, a lot of people just want to just power onto it. It's like,
yeah. Bend and wire and prune and crush and deadwood and chainsaws. Yeah, I think that there is. I had an interesting experience. I was working in Minnesota this past weekend and I was pruning this beautiful little hinoki, really humble. Not humble in terms of the composition, but humble in terms of the tree that created part of the composition, and you know, trying to hustle to get through the work. And there was just a moment where I made two bad cuts, and I put my scissors down. I was like, I'm done for the night. Like, this is where the train. I'm trying to get done. It's 9 o'clock at night. Like, I'm feeling antsy and anxious. And I was like, this is when you walk away. And the client I was with was super understanding, but also at the same time, he kind of had this puzzled look on his face. Like, you're a professional, you know. And like, I felt that in myself. But at the same time, it's like when you know that sensation. You know that you walk away at that point in time. That's when you step back and you look at the tree. That's when you slow down the process. And we came back at it the next morning, and I'm so happy I did, because the decisions I was making were to get finished, not to the betterment of the tree.
It's funny because that's what does make you a professional then.
Interesting, right?
Is walking away.
You would think.
Not if you kept doing it would make you more of an amateur, and then you fuck up it. Client Street.
Totally.
Wasn't there a song about that? The Gambler. Nowhere to hold him.
Wow.
Nowhere to walk away.
Did Willie Nelson write that song?
I don't know.
Is that the Henry Miller Band?
Yeah, I think it's that one.
Steve Miller Band.
There we go.
Henry Rollins.
Yeah, I'm meshing Steve everything. Miller
come together.
I feel like Willie Nelson may have done a cover of that, but then didn't Willie Nelson not know when to hold him?
Walk away.
I'm not sure. I should probably step back from this because I'm clearly speaking from a stance of ignorance in this project, but yeah.
But that's all about like the ego aspect of bonsai and keeping that in check. And you know, that's you kind of have to train yourself to do that at times, you know.
Yeah.
And that's where the one aspect of bonsai, like the sort of the self growth, you know, growing as a person as well, you know, you're growing yourself as well as your trees can come into it. And I've always enjoyed that aspect of the bonsai pursuit.
You feel like bonsai has made you a better person?
Absolutely.
Really?
Not just bonsai, but the people I've interacted with. Both the chief and everybody associated with Shunkai and my senpai, good and bad.
Mm.
The chief's wife, particularly. Customers that I dealt with in Japan. People I've dealt with back here, yourself, everybody here. It's just kind of like, you know, just being sort of privileged in this position where everybody's sort of pursuing something that they really enjoy. And then having to just sort of deal with it all.
Mm-hmm.
Just makes you, and the self-employed aspect of it as well. I mean, that's always been a huge challenge. And
interesting. Huh. That's a very interesting thing that you just said, just in terms of the fact that as opposed to potentially other pursuits and endeavors where there may be other motivations like monetary motivations, that really doesn't exist in bonsai, at least if that is the motivation, it's a quick in and out.
Yeah, anybody I know that does it for money is scum of the earth. Basically.
Yeah. And probably is ultimately destined for failure.
Yeah, and they get found out pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then all of a sudden you, and I think this is, like finds like, those people that are in it because they do this because they love it and it's a joy. Then all of a sudden you get down to a very core group of people doing it I feel like this is where, and I don't know how you feel about this, I feel like this is where my apprenticeship really paid off, because if I didn't absolutely love bonsai, there is no making it through an apprenticeship.
No.
There is no making it through an apprenticeship.
No.
And that's where it's interesting to see apprenticeships get cut short for whatever reason.
Mm.
And then it's like, did the trial and tribulation or the testing grounds that really give you the structure to be successful at bonsai, did you have enough time? Did that occur where you really know that bonsai is what you want to do?
Yeah, I think a lot of people just kind of, I saw it so much that it just didn't mean enough to them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one thing that Chief always said, is like, if you love it enough, you get good at it. If you love it enough, you put the time in.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to love it. Otherwise, you're not going to succeed. And people who thought that they did, quit after a week, a month, a year.
Yeah.
Saw them fall by the wayside. So, I mean, I loved it. I found the trials and the tribulations very hard to deal with, a lot of it, but I was stubborn. I just did not want to lose.
Yeah.
There were times when I was just grinding through it, just hated it.
Yeah.
Just did not want to lose.
Yeah.
Did not want to have them turn around and laugh at me.
Yeah. Or have the pleasure of saying, guess you didn't like it enough.
Yeah.
I had those moments too where it's like, the only reason I'm staying here right now is,
I do not want to hear you say that.
It's so that you can't say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I guess maybe is a little bit of a speaking to an ego sort of a thing.
I guess so. I guess it is. I mean, you definitely need ego to survive and to do what we do.
Yeah.
It's just keeping that in check.
Yeah.
It's like a runner is, you know, doing a marathon. I think they don't want to quit halfway through. I'm sure every time they got to talk themselves through it.
Yeah.
Lime, you've had a mic this entire time.
Who the hell is that?
He waits the whole time, and he's like, "Oh, by the way, like I'm fully
too.
Equipped to speak, and have not.
I'm here too."
Yeah, marathon runners, you do have to. I've run a couple marathons, and A, it's terrible, but B, yeah, you have to like be like, "Oh, right, why am I doing this? Oh, okay." And then he like many times, it's very painful.
The shame of not finishing. Painful.
Also, Kenny Rogers was the most famous for singing The Gambler.
Oh, now you're coming with it.
You've just been Googling that.
Right. That entire time, he was actually just like going through his mind. He had no phone out. He was like, Kenny Loggins, Kenny, no, Steve
the
Miller,
database.
Henry Miller.
I actually have their album.
Henry
so
Nelson.
I just say that.
I'm going to draw some attention to Lime's sock game today.
Okay. All the time.
I feel like every time we do a podcast, there's a moment where you do speak and it's like, oh, Lime, there you are. And then it's like, God, those socks, man.
These are good ones. I got Timber Joey right there.
Wow.
Pickle green.
Wow. Like yeah, just glowing.
Timber socks,
neon
man.
Yellow green.
Timber sock. Was that?
Timber sock.
Yeah, you guys should talk football. That's what we really want to hear.
Easy. Easy.
Ooh, we've already had this conversation.
Oh, you've already done this?
Yeah. It was over and done with.
Uh-huh. We had a good talk yesterday.
It was over before it started.
there's no reply to that. They do suck this year.
Ooh. Yeah. No, we're not doing very good.
But
still
they did,
love them.
They did win the MLS Cup. How many years ago?
2 years ago. I mean, 15.
Not bad.
Well,
not bad.
You know what?
Sun shines on the dog's ass one day.
Oh, my God.
Gives you hope, right?
Gives you hope.
It gives you hope.
Are you reflecting on your own life here with that one?
Absolutely.
Lesson to live by. The sun's going to come back. I know it.
Yeah. August 3rd, apparently.
There it is. Seriously, though, Lime.
I have a large Timber socks collection.
Wow.
How many socks?
Many socks, a lot of socks. Strong sock game, strong scarf game.
Yeah. Scarf game is definitely stronger, but yeah.
Huh. Yeah. I don't know. Those beer socks you had on last time were moving.
Those are good.
I was touched by those. Drinking this, what is this jasmine green tea?
I grabbed the wrong keg this morning. Busy's going to be really pissed. I grabbed the, she calls it the Green Gambler, I think some.
Green Gambler.
Speaking of. Kenny Rogers.
Yeah. I grabbed the wrong one, but it's still good.
What is it?
I don't know. I have to ask her. I didn't text her.
Very pleasant.
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
Drinkable. It's not too strong.
Uh-huh.
A little bit fruity.
Makes for a strong podcast.
It does. I've been enjoying it all afternoon.
That's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. There's some Italian liqueur over there made from olives that also can contribute to some pretty radical podcasts.
As you can see by the history of the bottle.
Take far down. Fewer drinks of that to make an interesting podcast.
At least interesting to us anyway.
Yeah, right.
About the listeners.
What the hell are they talking about?
Do you guys have craft beer in the UK, or is that not
like the English language, we invented beer.
Oh my God.
No.
Yes, we do. The craft beer thing kind of, I don't want to say it kicked off like more in the UK and in Europe before it did here. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like similarly sort of going off, I suppose. But yeah, it was a lot of craft breweries.
Mm.
Guys invented the English language, football, beer. What else?
Cricket. Humor.
Okay, we're second.
Humor.
We're second rate. Okay?
The
we're
darker side of humor.
Yeah.
You said that, not me.
Okay, all right.
We'll throw that out there. But anyway, but yeah. So, the little town where I live, we've got a little craft beer pub that Steve Silesian's been to, and
nice.
Everyone else, and we go there and just have a few beers.
I feel like there's a story that you worked in a pub at one point.
Yeah, I grew up working in a pub.
Nice.
in my hometown, which was always interesting.
A bit colorful.
Yeah, it was very colorful. I mean, it was where I grew up was out in the countryside, and like the legal drinking age in the UK is 18, and we basically started going into pubs from the age of about 14.
Yeah,
it was fine. It was just countryside. It's fine. Yeah, as long as you don't get into too much trouble. And the police used to actually call up all the pubs and say, "We're going to come around and check. Just make sure everyone's out." So the landlord would say, "The police come in, just finish drinks and go outside for an hour."
Wow. That's amazing.
That would be awesome.
We'd go into the park and go on the swings and then go back into the pub. So, yeah, very much a pub culture.
Yeah.
And then I started working in there, university, college breaks. And then after I finished university, before I went to Japan, it was always interesting.
Cool. That's very cool. Do you think that gave you a greater appreciation for beer? Is that part of being British?
No, it gave me a greater appreciation of not being a lousy drunk.
Ah. Pulled your alcohol.
No, that's a lime.
Well, slow down here. No. It's not that bad.
Ooh.
Not that bad.
I'm a happy drunk. I never start fights or anything.
You're always kind. You're very kind.
No. You're a very happy drunk.
It's true. Peter is too. Peter tends to go narcoleptic. I've seen Peter fall asleep in some pretty amazing situations.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
You don't. Yeah, you do that as well, but no alcohol required.
Ah,
yeah.
Dang it. Dang it.
Yeah, narcolepsy is the one real. Thing the travel. Told me, right before we went to Italy, he's like, just watch where he falls asleep.
Protect him.
And I started texting him pictures of you falling asleep.
This is a thing now.
Yeah, yeah.
The ritual
was, at least when we were in Italy, it was the same every night. It was you would open UFC, you'd watch some highlights,
laptop.
And then pass out.
Would I really?
The laptop. Yeah. The laptop gets you.
You know, like, everybody's got their comfort blankets.
Yeah.
Of like things they do to like turn off mentally, and for whatever reason it's archaic cage fighting that for me.
Watching other people
right
bludgeon themselves half to death.
I don't know, like there's an intellectual part of it which everybody can argue that it's just raw violence and that whatever, but I mean like there's like a lot of strategy and skill and stuff, and I really appreciate that, but sometimes just watching two people punch each other in the face is like, oh, okay. I don't have to think a lot about that, you know, like, not much to analyze here, and I find a lot of comfort in that.
Fair enough.
Yeah,
fair enough.
Shut it down. Bro.
I mean, I definitely go on YouTube and just go down dark holes. And
do you?
You are the master of that, dude.
Not like dark videos, just you're just like, just weird. How does this exist? It's weird. It has no reason to
the
be here.
The amount of
but...
content that is out there is just hideous. It's just like, what? Yeah. Why would you even make that?
Mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Mind-boggling.
To the links that some people go to, too, I applaud them. You're just like, wow, that...
Dedicated.
As people that make video and photo and such, when you stumble on a good YouTube video, you're like, that was like weeks of your life. Like, that was a full-time job for a minute, dude. Like, to make this video on YouTube that possibly no one will see.
Might just get lost in the ether.
The sea of dross.
Yeah.
I always think about that. Even like home videos, but you're like, wow, they actually like, that's a lot of time they spent
that's
doing
a lot of
that.
Time.
Yeah, I mean, on the other side too, I've worked on like commercial work and stuff that like gets like 100 views on YouTube, and you're like, I mean, no promises.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's a, it's, it was made to be
digested and distributed.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing. And to think about the number of people that and money that goes into some of those things that never.
Oh, yeah.
That's like Brian being, in his design work, being like 10% of what I create ever gets seen. And it's just like,
Yeah.
I've done that a lot with commercial video shoots. Yeah. I've been on projects where the budget's, you know, $100,000. It's all internal. They just use it for like meetings for the employees they already hire.
Yeah.
And you're just like, wow. Okay.
It's a lot of money.
You just got 10 really creative people in a room to create a fully dialed out thing, you know, bring a concept to life, and it's literally going to be like a 2-second clip on an app that your like trainees use.
Yeah.
It's like crazy. Hardcore, man. I can't even fathom that.
Yeah.
It's not cool. Yeah.
Well, let's think about like
money's cool though.
Talk about photos and videos and by extension design too. It's like so much of what we make people don't notice. I mean, even though we absorb so much imagery, like, people forget. I mean, now we run, like, we run the website, and, like, you're sure you become aware how much goes into just, like, upload. Like, every image, every piece of text, everything is considered. I mean, if you're trying to make something that...
If you're trying to make it well.
Yeah. But everything is considered to a certain extent. Like, even if you're making, you know, a very basic, simple website, you're still, like... Every image, every font, every like color, like everything, and but 99% of people don't notice that, you know.
But that's the same for bonsai. The maintenance style of side of bonsai.
The maple, like, and that little just amount little of work bits of pruning across
here and there. Yeah. And it's like almost that the things that don't really make a huge difference, the cumulative effect of those things over a year, over 2 years, over 5 years, over 10 years. You don't notice the little details, but at the end, it's those details that go into making a really good product or a really bad product. Mm-hmm. It's the same with websites. It's the same with any kind of design. All the process is exactly the same.
And it seems to me everybody's hope in making those things, whether it's a website, a photograph, a video, or a bonsai tree, your hope is that there's going to be albeit probably a very small population of people, you hope there's somebody out there that sees it and they're like, damn.
Yeah.
You hope.
You hope that they see it, but at the same time, when we're coming back to the talking about the process, you know, the process of doing it, a lot of it is I just do it for my own benefit.
Yeah,
I just do it for my own pleasure.
Sure.
It's like, because I know that I've got...
Okay.
I'm really hungry too, dude.
Yeah, I think everybody's really hungry. we'll wrap up here and eat something. How's that sound?
But part of it is you do it for your own benefit because you just don't want to put out an inferior product. You don't want to just do an okay job because you can get away with doing an okay job. Mm-hmm. You know, that's that personal professional pride, I suppose.
How big is that payoff though? When somebody goes like, hey, like your work is tight and all, but like the way that the exposure you shot that image at, or the, you know, the angle or the vantage point that you produced that, or the, like, dude, the ramification on that tree, you know, and you're just like, oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Uh-huh. You don't even know.
Yeah. Definitely. Like, I mean, I agree with you, Peter. Like, you know, if you don't like the process, you're not going to do it for long.
Absolutely.
But I mean, same thing with, I think, a lot of art forms, like whether you're a furniture designer, a photographer, a painter, whatever it is, like we live in very niche bubbles. And, you know, I'll see someone, I mean, I'll know a photographer that I'm like, oh my God, their work is amazing. Like, they are, to me, they're like a celebrity.
Right.
But, you know, 99% of the population is like, who? What? And then you show them and they're like, okay.
Cool.
Like,
yeah.
But have you seen the new Transformers movie?
Right.
You
know?
Yeah. But that, I think, in that way, it sort of teaches you, at least taught me, like, you can't do it for fame or attention because, you know, we're not necessarily in the business of mainstream fandom and whatever. So.
This is like one thing that we have with the modern kind of like social media based lifestyle. Like, people could become obsessed with like the quantity of likes and then like how popular am I? Where's my ranking? It's not quantity that matters. It's the quality of the likes. Like, does the person who's pressed like, do they actually know what they're looking at?
Mm-hmm.
Or are they just pressing it because they press it on everything?
I think...
Same with the dislikes. Like, there's people that just go around and dislike crap.
Yeah,
it's true. But I think this comes back to, you know, Lime. Like, I feel like Lime is a little bit of the Lost Jedi.
Oh.
Because, I mean, it is. Like, I always refer to you as the Jedi in the live streams, and there's a reason for that. There's this not conscious quality that exists in the audio of Mirai, whether it's the podcast, whether it's the live stream, anything that we do. But Lime, I refer to you as the Jedi because you're doing this thing that I think a lot of people are not conscious of and a lot of people don't really appreciate, and that is this the audio engineering and the quality of the sound and stuff. And when you listen to other sound and you listen to the production quality, people don't recognize how much goes into good audio. And you slave over it painstakingly without any need for recognition. And I just, I can't thank you enough for the quality that you deliver to Mariah. It's phenomenal, you know, and you are this, this, you know, enigma of a figure that's mastering this thing that everybody's experiencing, and they are experiencing at a level that allows them to not notice it because it sounds so good.
And that's where we have to be.
And that's the art form that you excel at.
If you know I'm here, then I did something wrong.
Yeah, but kudos to you, man. Kudos to you when we talk about all of the underappreciated details and efforts and stuff. You know, you don't get enough recognition for what you do. And I think inside of this conversation, it's a good opportunity to point that out.
Thanks, brother.
Yeah. I mean, and especially working with audiovisual, like, you know, what we're doing, people don't realize, but they taught this to us in film school, which is most people, 9 out of 10 people won't notice bad image, but 10 out of 10 people will notice bad sound, because it's such a intrinsic thing that it is our experience of sound. It's like if you watch something that is like half a second off sync, it really bothers
it's
you.
It's disturbing.
You're just like, oh no, I can't. Or like when, you know, you can watch someone filming a cell phone video, and if the sound is good, people won't notice that it's a cell phone video.
It's tolerable.
Yeah, exactly. And because most people don't, you know, we don't think about listening, but yeah, that it does make a big difference.
I care a lot about it. I have to say that. I also have a lot of experience, so.
You love to twiddle those knobs.
I do. Only your knobs, buddy.
Well, I appreciate it. You always make me sound better.
So. Well, good. I like that. I like working up here. Ryan's easy to work with. All of you guys are great to work with. We've created a very cohesive group, so it's been good.
Peter, always a pleasure to have you here, man.
It's always been it's a pleasure to be here.
Nice.
Hope the next time will be fairly soon.
Sooner rather than later.
Sooner rather than later.
I hope so,
we'll
too.
Have to make that happen.
I hope so, too. The whole crew really anticipates your visits with a lot of... a lot of glee.
Then you guys all need a hobby, is what I can say. You need better things to look forward to than just some random English dick.
Way to go, man.
Sorry, man.
Way to go. Way to reinforce the English stereotype. I never have any doubt that we're going to be British tainted when you're gone.
Tainted by the Brits.
Real deal, dude. You dropped some knowledge on us. It's nice to get to exchange some thoughts.
It's always a learning privilege for me as well.
Nice. Safe travels, and we'll look forward to seeing what you produce as you keep going.
Cool.
Right on, brother. Love you
too.
Later.
Bye.